News, sports, weather from Dr. Bill Williams, traffic info from Kane, and one of the Gulf Coast's most familiar voices. It's Mobile Mornings with Dan Brennan and Dalton Arwig.
Yes, it is. Dan and Dalton, FM Talk 106.5 at 7 minutes after 8 o'clock.
A couple traffic updates for you. As Kane said, hold on to the wheel. Are there people not holding on to the wheel?
I guess.
Drive across the Bayway?
The little trick driving there.
Yeah, dangerous. Michael says, wreck on Cottage Hill at Knollwood. A city dump truck hit a small SUV.
Wow.
Yeah, I hope everyone's fine in that one. City dump truck hit a small SUV. That's at Cottage Hill and Knollwood. And reported this at the end of last hour. Thank you, Jason. This morning there are, he says, seven cars with flat tires between Celeste Road and Highway 43 on northbound 65. So be careful if you're traveling northbound 65. Plenty of cars with flat tires, it sounds like, between Celeste and 43.
Gee, weird. I've had that situation on 43 yesterday, right? It's 7 minutes after 8 o'clock with Quinn Hillier from QuinnHillier.com and the Washington Examiner. Quinn, good morning. We've got a whole bunch to get into. How are you doing today?
I'm doing okay. How are y'all?
Doing good.
Doing fine. And some candidates finally jumping in District 1 and District 2, as primaries aren't very far away. We'll have March primaries and then the general election next November. Current sitting congressman for District 1, Jared Carl, he was the first to announce that he would be running for re-election. And then the news came down yesterday that Barry Moore, who's the District 2 sitting U.S. congressman, will be running in District 1, where his home now resides after the redistricting from earlier this year. Let's start with that and then in a little bit get into who's running for District 2. But your thoughts on Barry Moore jumping into the race?
Barry Moore has a slightly uphill battle against Jerry Carl, especially since Carl got in faster. But even though Carl does not live in Baldwin County, but he's represented Baldwin County, and Baldwin County is, in effect, the population center of this sprawling district now. I mean, it's a sprawling district, and it's, you know, it's tough to say there is any one population center, but Baldwin is as much a one as any. And plus, Jerry Carl has gotten already endorsements from local officials all the way across the new district, and I don't think Barry Moore has won yet. But in Barry Moore's favor is that he will probably have outside money coming in from the Club for Growth, which for some reason doesn't like Jerry Carl. And who knows what Donald Trump will do. I mean, there's no reason for Donald Trump to get involved either way. But if he weighs in on one side or another, that could have an effect. But either way, I still think, and I think most people think, Jerry Carl goes in at least with a mild advantage.
Yeah, I would say so. And you could tell the different styles they're going to come into this race with, or at least on Barry Moore's side, as he made his announcement. He is clearly going to try to run as the more conservative candidate. He's a member of the House Freedom Caucus. He kept mentioning how now with this new, the way this district's drawn up, it's one of the top conservative voting district in the entire nation.
Sixth in the nation, I think, right?
And just looking at our text line and some phone calls we've gotten, I know even some folks around here have already said they would prefer Moore over Carl. And I know Congressman Carl's been in the wiregrass quite a bit, kind of getting ahead of this vote to make sure he's known as well over there as he is over here. But I think we might look back at this and it could be a pretty tight primary, even though I do agree Carl is the favorite.
Well, yes. And look, it's pretty tough to say that Jerry Carl hasn't been conservative enough. I mean, he's voted, as far as I can tell, right down the line with conservatives. He's voted right down the line with the MAGA crowd. Other than the way that Moore sometimes talks a little more, you know, hard line, I don't see much difference in their voting record. So, you know, Moore's going to try to act as if he is somehow much more conservative than Jerry Carl. Whether that's true or not, it's very doubtful.
Could you, for those who don't, you know, aren't as politically inclined, explain exactly what the Club for Growth is and how they can affect an election, and maybe even how they've affected elections in the past right around here?
Well, the Club for Growth was founded, 25 years ago or so, maybe 30 years ago, and they were formed mostly by supply-siders, by tax cutters, but tax cut and, you know, and then smaller government folks who wanted to, their whole goal is to get involved in Republican primaries to push the most, at first it just was the most supply-side candidate out there.
Mm-hmm.
And what they do is rather than give directly to campaigns, they do a lot of what's known as outside spending, which is in many ways all but unlimited. So rather than give $5,000 to some candidate, they will not directly coordinate with a candidate, but they might drop a couple hundred thousand dollars in their own advertising on that candidate's behalf.
Mm-hmm.
They've made a lot of people mad over the years because they get in and they start throwing money around, and they can be very, very vicious. They can do ads less for their guy than negative ads against the other guy. And they're also sort of weird in terms of who they support now. It's tough to figure out any consistency with them. They did support Hightower against Jerry Carl last time, and Carl beat Hightower anyway. And they haven't necessarily had as much success in Alabama as in other places. But still, if they come in, it means a several $100,000 boost for their guy.
And they spent basically for Barry Moore in his District 2 race. You can see how they will likely swing in this District 1 race.
It's not just the money spent, they're involved in the messaging, maybe inflammatory messaging?
Well, again, by law, they're not supposed to coordinate with the candidate, but yes, they tend to use very inflammatory messaging, which means these days it means very negative campaigning. And I said they didn't have much success in Alabama. The big exception was Barry Moore, who was not supposed to win that District 2 race and came from way behind with the help of Club for Growth. So I think he's counting on that again.
Okay. No doubt about that. Talking with Quinn Hillier with the Washington Examiner. Also, you can find his work at quinnhillier.com, and he's also written a trilogy that's up on Amazon. Let's talk a little bit about District 2. And it seemed like at least all the Democrats were waiting to see if the mayor of Montgomery would drop into the race, Stephen Reed, and his dad, of course, with the importance in statewide Democrat politics, Joe Reed. Stephen Reed will not run, but there are several that have either already put their name in on the Democrat side or are expected to soon. State Senator Kirk Hatcher out of Montgomery will run. State Representative Napoleon Bracey out of Pritchard, he says that he will run.
He's going to go up to Montgomery today or tomorrow, and I think the deadline is the 10th of November, but he's going to get that. He's going to square that away.
So those two guys are from the district, but then you have Merrica Coleman, who is a state politician out of Birmingham, and also reports that House Minority Leader Anthony Daniels, who is out of Huntsville, is strongly considering a run for District 2. Now, I don't know who the Republican will end up being that they face, but, I mean, there's a possibility here, Quinn, where, say, Barry Moore wins, and say one of these politicians out of Huntsville or Birmingham wins District 2. I mean, Mobile and Baldwin County could be technically without representation.
You're very right, and that is one reason that what the Supreme Court did was just awful. It is not good for the politics of a state, not good for the constituents of a state to have their districts drawn specifically on the basis of race rather than on the basis of, you know, actual geographical affinity, actual involvement with the economies of the local districts. But they have set up a situation, and the state legislatures didn't make it any better because they didn't make the best of a bad situation. They made the worst of a bad situation. They've set up a situation where basically all anybody's looking at is the race of the candidate, and And so you've got these people who say, okay, this is a black district. I'm a black state representative. I'm going to go run there, even though I do not live there. To me, that's just wrong. I mean, it's technically constitutionally allowable, but it's wrong. I hope the voters, just on that basis alone, say, look, this person has nothing to do with our district, has never had anything to do with our district. We will not vote for them. And so that's why, you know, on the Democratic side, somebody like Napoleon Bracey, who is, you know, who is either in or within a couple of blocks of the district, I mean, basically most of the area that he has represented is in the district, he should get locals supporting him for that reason alone. But who knows what will actually happen.
Yeah, I mean, when it comes down to it, if we're looking at the Democratic primary, Bracey's our guy, right? I mean, he's the only one that would have any ties to the area.
Well, so far. I mean, there's
so far.
Vivian Figures, and I think also talk of Vivian Figures, I think it's her son, who might get in the race. So we might, you know, we've still got, what?
2 days.
Ten more days before it's all over, and that's just on the Democratic side. So we, you know, we could have several other local candidates, but right now the only local one, is, I mean, not just local, the only one really in the district other than that Montgomery guy is Napoleon Bracey, and of course he is a local for us.
Now, Quinn, if you were drawing up the campaign for a Republican to run in District 2, and so many people asking why Barry Moore isn't running in 2 and he's instead running in 1, I think it's because of the swing in the demographics of the voter. I mean, it looks to me like you'll have to be considered a somewhat moderate Republican to have a chance in District 2, and definitely wouldn't consider Congressman Barry Moore a moderate Republican. What kind of Republican do you think it'll take to hop into that race and win?
It would have to be somebody with a record of, A, you know, working across racial lines and across party lines. It would have to be somebody, you know, who has a record as a, as not a compromiser, but as a, you know, somebody who tries to unify people. And it would have to be somebody who is very, very energetic, because this is a crazy shaped district. It goes all the way from the Mississippi line to the Georgia line. It would help if you've got somebody with roots all across the district. I mean, you know, if you're if you live in Mobile but your grandfather was born in Eufaula, that might help. Something like that, where you can go in and say, look, you know, I grew up with some sense of affinity for the entire scope of the district. Something like that. And even then, it's an uphill battle. I think the numbers were this. It was either 12 or 13, but something like of the past 15 races in this district, I mean, the district wasn't a district at the time.
Right.
If you take the voters from what is now the district in the past 15 races in Alabama, I think 13 of them voted for Democrats.
Interesting. So it would be an uphill battle no matter what.
Definitely an uphill battle for a Republican, but not an absolutely impossible one.
And one name that I've heard, and that kind of came and went, was Dick Brubaker, I guess former state senator from Montgomery, that he's got, maybe he's got the chops for it. I don't know. What's your opinion on him real quick?
Brubaker is still talking about it, from what I understand. He was sort of a moderate conservative, and he fits the mold, at least in that way, but he's been awfully quiet. You'd think that he would be making a little more noise, although he was on Jeff Moore's show last week. So maybe, you know, maybe he's still looking at it.
Okay. All right, Quinn, can you hang on a second? And we've got more to talk about.
Yeah, including the new House Speaker in his first week in that role, and funding, the first thing they have to tackle here, involving wars going on the other side of the world, but you also have the upcoming budget deadline. So we'll talk with Quinn about that when we get back right here on Mobile Mornings. Thanks, Kane. 825. Back to our conversation with Quinn Hillier in just a moment. This segment brought to you by the local personal injury law firm Tobias and Comer Law. And they're always trying their best to make sure that everyone's staying safe out there. October is Pedestrian Safety Awareness Month, and that makes sense with Halloween, right?
Yes,
a lot
it
of
does.
Folks in the road
it really
tonight.
Does, yeah.
In October, for the last year that they have these stats, 2021, there were 125 total pedestrian fatalities. That's 15th in the United States. And Halloween is certainly a night where something as life-changing as that can certainly happen. And Tobias and Comer Law, they have great resources on their website, including some tips for both pedestrians and drivers. For pedestrians, walk on a sidewalk or a path when it's available. Always walk facing traffic. Never assume the driver sees you. Be predictable, be visible, and don't walk under the influence. And those are some great tips to start hammering into your children's heads today as you walk with them as trick-or-treating. Let them know how to properly and safely walk through traffic. And for drivers, look for pedestrians everywhere. Don't assume they will be where they should be. Be cautious in poorly lit places. Always stop at crosswalks and never drive under the influence. Also follow speed limits. These are some things that sound easy, but they could certainly save and change some lives. Tobias and Comer Law, they know that to be the case, and you can find out a lot more about them online at tobiascomerlaw.com. You can also call for a free consultation at any time at 251-432-5001, tobiascomerlaw.com.
New House Speaker Mike Johnson, maybe a week in now, Quinn, and his plate is full.
His plate is very full, and he doesn't really have any training for the job. He has stepped right in and said that aid for Ukraine, Israel, and the border should be voted on separately rather than together. And really, there's no reason why not, as long as he will allow a free and fair vote on each of the three. In fact, it's good to break things up rather than bundle things together. But, again, only if he allows a full and fair vote. If he does this, allows a vote on Israel, and then says, oops, sorry, you're not even getting a vote on Ukraine because I'm the speaker and I'm gonna put my foot down, that's not fair and it's not right. He has to now understand that he doesn't represent a tiny constituency in northwest Louisiana. He represents the entire institution of the House, and he's a constitutional officer representing the whole country. As long as he does that, he's smart enough to be a very good speaker.
And this will be interesting if they do split the vote up. I think it was Jimenez out of Florida who said he can't wait to see who on the left votes against aid to Israel.
Yeah, we can almost guess, right?
But I can imagine there's Democrats saying they can't wait to see who on the right votes against aid to Ukraine. So mm-hmm. This will really kind of show where people stand if they split it up.
Well, exactly. And again, things should fall or rise or fall on their own. It drives me nuts, has driven me nuts for 30, 40 years to see them constantly putting these huge packages together where it's all or nothing, and you might oppose one part of it and support the other part of it, and it's not fair to make you choose between something you really, really like and something you really, really detest and have to vote on it all at once. It's not fair. He's absolutely right if he wants to separate it, again, as long as he is fair about it.
And you also have the appropriations bills leading up to the next deadline for the federal funding, November 17th. I know Biden said they would veto the appropriations bills that they don't like coming out of the House, but we have time to talk about that in the weeks ahead. Quinn, if folks want to follow you online and get your work, how can they do so?
QuinnHillier.com just Google Quinn Hillier and Washington Examiner. You can also Google Quinn Hillier and NOLA.com, NOLA.com, because occasionally I have things in the New Orleans paper.
Buy your books on Amazon. That money's just going to roll in, Quinn. We'll talk to you in 1 week, my man. Thank you so much.
Thanks a lot.
All right, Quinn Hillier. And coming up, we'll turn up your voice, 251-343-0106. An interesting article about Ukraine funding from Time Magazine, of all places. More later.
Morning from Dan and Dalton, FM Talk 106.5, 835 on Mobile Mornings. The Ascension Technologies text line. Basically ignored that thing this morning. Sorry about that. 251-343-0106.
And we've been getting some traffic updates, as we do every morning. We really appreciate you guys letting us know when you get to a safe location and you can text. From earlier, Michael said there was a wreck. This came in at 8, so possible that it's cleared now. But he said wreck on Cottage Hill at Knollwood. A city dump truck hit a small SUV. And then previously, we also had, I think it was Jason, if I can find it, who said he saw 7 vehicles on the side of the road with flat tires on northbound 65 between Celeste Road and Highway 43. 7 with flats between Celeste and 43. That's on northbound 65. And that follows yesterday up on 43 between Jackson and Grove Hill, where many, many more vehicles had flat tires. And that's because some vehicle was dropping what looks like steel. This one person on Facebook said, nicknamed French fries. They come off the trimmings from coils of metal from one of the steel mills, and they think they were headed to the melt shop, and these steel shavings were just falling all over Highway 43. They actually had to close it down for some time yesterday as they cleared that up. Thankfully, some folks knew which vehicle was dropping these metal shavings, and they were able to get a hold of them. So now they knew who to blame. They're going to have to pay up, it sounds like.
Yeah, but also, I mean, these are small items, right?
They look like window siding, honestly. So they look like they could be.
So they're big enough.
They're about 6 inches, if I had to guess.
Okay.
About
well,
six
I'm,
inches.
I'm just
long.
Saying to make sure you drop some on your floor, a bunch of things.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe it could be noodles, could be whatever. Suddenly it's on your floor. You rarely get them all the first go round. So what I'm saying is, hopefully the road is now crystal clear, because
yeah.
That was such a problem yesterday.
Yeah, and basically like knives all up and down Highway 43.
Exactly.
Absolutely crazy. We'll get to the text line here in a minute. I did want to get to this, as I think it's an interesting theory. Maybe you think I'm completely off my rocker regarding Putin and what role he or Russia possibly played in the Hamas attack on Israel. But let me point this out first. And this is with on the heels of the conversation we were having with Quinn there, that the new House Speaker, Mike Johnson, says they will split the funding in votes because Biden asked for $106 billion in funding, around $60 billion of that, more than $60 billion going towards the war in Ukraine, right around $14 billion going towards Israel, and that's for Iron Dome and I think rockets for the Iron Dome and other security measures for Israel. And then another 15 odd billion for what they're calling border security. But Congressman Jerry Carl, when he was on with Sean a couple weeks ago, said it's not really border security. They're just hiring more people to get folks through the border more efficiently and quickly.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then I forget what the rest was. There was another billion something for
Taiwan.
Yeah. Yes. Indo-Pacific relations. Mm-hmm. So Mike Johnson says he's going to split all of that up. And it will be interesting to see who on the left or right votes against Israel funding. And then same for Ukraine funding, although I doubt there will be many on the left voting against funding for Ukraine. But one of the great follows on Twitter X is this guy, and he's anonymous, Kane Koa the Great. But he's done some really good investigative deep dives over the last year or two. And he pulled up this Time Magazine article. And you can kind of see the national and international media, their view of the Ukraine-Russia war kind of shifting a little bit. I'll just read his tweet to you. And he kind of lays out what Time does in the article. It said, Time Magazine reports that Ukraine is struggling to rally financial support after its failed counteroffensive and amid allegations of widespread corruption. And that's certainly the case. You could see Zelensky saying, hey, don't forget about us. We're still here, even with what's going on in Israel, and we need funding in a big way. So from the article, or from this tweet, he says, a top Ukrainian presidential advisor warns that, quote, people are stealing like there's no tomorrow, when he was asked about bribes and corruption. Of course, corruption would be nothing new to Ukraine. 59% of Americans don't want Congress to provide more weapons to Kiev. That's up from 35% in June, according to this Time article. 35% support in June, up to 59% now against providing more weapons to Kiev. They point out the southeastern fifth of Ukraine, where the population is predominantly Russian-speaking, still remains under Russian control. So the counteroffensive, I think they have made some ground, but not nearly what's been taken since Russia back in 2014 invaded Crimea.
Right.
Zelensky's close advisor warns that, quote, he deludes himself. We're out of options. We're not winning, but try telling him that. Also, he writes, Ukraine's shortage of soldiers is more dire than its deficit in arms and ammunition. Draft officers are pulling men off trains and buses and sending them straight to the front of the war.
Wow.
And that was a tweet I saw months ago at this point. And it was, I guess, supposed to show that, you know, the Ukrainian people are so anti-Russian and pro-Ukraine. And, of course, they are fighting, like Sean says, Tar Heels here. They are fighting for their home country in many cases. But they were showing elderly fighters. And by elderly, not like old people, but 50, 60-year-old men going out and fighting. And if you've studied any kind of war history, you know that when the 50 and 60-year-old men are out there, that you've ran a little short of the 18 to 25-year-olds.
Sure.
Also, the death toll has long surpassed 100,000 on each side of the war, forcing the draft of the elderly, raising the average age of a Ukrainian soldier to 43 years.
Wow.
That's the average age of a Ukrainian soldier fighting now, 43 years old. He adds, corruption remains widespread despite Zelensky firing numerous officers and the defense minister. Zelensky's worried that the focus of Ukraine's allies in the U.S. and Europe and of the global media has already shifted to Israel, Palestine, and the Gaza Strip. At least here recently, that's certainly the case. And this Twitter user, Kane Koa, says, why are Time Magazine and the corporate media starting to throw Ukraine and Zelensky under the bus? So that it's kind of, well, multiple conversations here. Is the international and national media starting to shift and say maybe there needs to be a peace deal done?
A lot of plates in the air, and people are exhausted by all of it.
They are.
And that's the oldest conflict of now with
what's going on
in Israel, for sure. And so you begin to cherry pick or pick and choose if you're going to take one or take the other. The other thing is, Dalton, think, and I want to get you to your Putin theory, which you found somewhere. You found morsels of and somebody put that idea where you're like, wait a minute, I think that's very interesting. But the Israel now is, for the most part, except for those who are Palestinian sympathizers, which I don't know if the number shocks me or if I should not be shocked by all of that. It just seems to be a larger percentage of the United States, just citizens alone, not even lawmakers, than I would have ever guessed. But the fact that Putin and has ties to Iran, and take it from there.
Well, yeah, just reading that and looking at how the House seems to be going about this Israel and Ukraine funding vote, where it's, a lot of Republican voters are against more funding to Ukraine,
sure,
like not another dime.
Yeah.
And there are people out there that say, hey, the U.S. can continue to fund both wars to the tune of tens of or hundreds of billions of dollars, and it serves our national interest. But you do have to wonder if we're getting spread thin. I'd say we're way past getting spread thin as far as finances go. But that makes sense. You look at who is maybe benefiting. There's a lot of people benefiting from war, of course, including stateside. But
internationally.
Internationally, Russia is benefiting from this Israel incursion into Gaza. They're benefiting because now the U.S., in a way, has to choose. And also, our attention, right?
Mm-hmm.
The attention of the world has now shifted away from Eastern Europe,
yep,
and is settled more on the Middle East.
Sure.
The funding, they may have been able to just move through more funding for the Ukraine war if this hadn't happened in Israel. So is it possible with Putin and the sway that Russia has over Iran, that he was like, hey, that little attack that Hamas has been working up for some time now that they've been training for in Iran? Why don't we get that going and also get Hezbollah involved? Then you have Israel facing at least two fronts, and the U.S. is beholden to helping Israel out. It would be a savvy move. Obviously, absolutely diabolical, but a savage move if Putin's like, let's get this thing going in the Middle East. It'll divert attention away from here, and maybe we can kind of wrap things up.
And around, too, because all of our attention on the next possible move was Taiwan. And also, isn't it just crazy that Israel, with the Gaza Strip right there, nobody knows it better than them, and somehow completely taken off guard by that attack?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's hard to believe that Israeli intelligence, I mean, right there, let alone U.S. intelligence, and I don't know how that's shared or the same thing, had never saw this coming, or what else could your theories be?
And, it came on a day that was important to, radical Muslims for sure, right? The 50-year anniversary of the Six-Day War, I think.
Mm-hmm.
So you would think they would be on high alert that day.
Exactly.
And Netanyahu has since, at least once, thrown his intelligence under the bus and blamed them, although I think he kind of had to walk that back.
He also said that he's not backing down. This is the time for war, is what he had to say yesterday at a press conference. So if there were people saying to him, hey, cease fire, he's saying, no, we're not doing that. Yep. This is IDF Lieutenant Colonel Jonathan Conricus. This is what he had to say yesterday.
Quite a lot of Hamas operatives that try to engage with our troops are no longer among us, and we will continue to operate like that at this pace and in different locations until we dismantle Hamas.
That's pretty definitive right there.
Yeah.
Hamas is the bad guys. We're going to eradicate them, period.
And it looks like Israel's begun hitting the tunnels today.
Mm-hmm.
That was a big question mark, is when were they going to start hitting the tunnels and going into the tunnels. Sean had a really good 2 hours yesterday as he threw some of these questions around about that war. Here was Netanyahu. This is what you referenced a minute ago. He's saying there will be no ceasefire.
Just as the United States would not agree to a ceasefire after the bombing of Pearl Harbor, or after the terrorist attack of 9/11, Israel will not agree to a cessation of hostilities with Hamas after the horrific attacks of October 7th.
And John Kirby with the National Security Council agrees.
We do not believe that a ceasefire is the right answer right now. We believe that a ceasefire right now benefits Hamas.
And, you know, we also talked about the Houthi rebels from Yemen,
mm-hmm.
which is south of Saudi Arabia, that they were firing long-range artillery into Israel, or trying to. The U.S. out in the Red Sea knocked down several of those, and drones. But a report from Bloomberg, and there's so many different rivalries in the Middle East, obviously. Bloomberg reports Saudi Arabia's military has gone into a state of high alert following deadly clashes with Yemen's Iran-backed Houthi rebels. Apparently, they just found out yesterday that Saudi Arabia also downed one of those missiles, and it landed in Saudi Arabia. They said four Saudi soldiers died in the fight with Houthi forces in the mountainous southwestern Jazan province on the border with Yemen. Saudi Arabia's defense forces also intercepted a missile in Saudi territory fired by the Houthis in the past few weeks. The Saudi deaths, which occurred last week, are the first known casualties for the country's forces since a tentative truce was reached with the Houthis in April of last year. They've been trying to negotiate an end to the war with those rebels, which started in 2015. Bloomberg says before the escalation, the two sides were on the cusp of a deal, despite the death of four Barani soldiers serving in the Saudi coalition in a Houthi drone attack last month. And this took place, they note, as we all know, as the Israel-Hamas conflict raises tension across the region. So we've all been talking about Hamas doing this attack as Israel was on the cusp of a peace deal with Saudi Arabia. But also you have Saudi Arabia working on a peace deal, or at least a truce, I should say, with the Houthi rebels in Yemen. That was also distorted by this entire thing.
Yeah, and then you've got what's going on in the United States, which is, it seems to just be window dressing in a way to the actual conflict itself. But it's pretty interesting window dressing, isn't it? The pro-Palestinian, pro-Hamas, basically, faction of that live in the United States.
Yeah.
A lot of them are younger students. Some of them are progressive Jews, which is mind-blowing.
And there was a new Gallup poll that over half of Muslim Americans agree or strongly agree that the Hamas attack on Israel was warranted.
Wow.
Over half. Now, it was a poll, right? So no telling how accurate it is. But you also had the Saudi defense minister, Khalid bin Salman, who was in Washington yesterday to meet with senior officials. So will this thing escalate even further? Sure looks like that's going to be the case.
And with those opinions, Muslim Americans, will there be an uptick of anti-Muslim in the United States as well?
I think that's certainly possible. After DeSantis made his move
in
Florida,
banning
pro-Palestine groups from college campuses, now the Biden administration yesterday unveiled a series of actions to combat rising anti-Semitism. And part of this includes the feds partnering with campus and local police to track hate-related rhetoric online and provide federal resources to schools. I'm sure that they wouldn't widen that federal cooperation with campus and local police, because you know, we've seen hate-related rhetoric, according to the feds, can be just about anything.
Yep,
so they're getting into local business even more and using this anti-Semitism on college campuses as the crux of it.
It is 850 with Dan and Dalton. Text line from Ascension Technologies, 251-343-0106. Light it up. 40 from Dan and Dalton, FM Talk 106.5 at 855. By the way, we had a U.S. Senator earlier this week from Washington State make a statement on one of the Sunday shows that Biden better watch it, and being pro-Israel, he would lose the Muslim vote. And you say, well, what does that mean? So it's 4.45 million Muslims are in the United States currently that you know, God knows what came across the border. I don't know. And I'm not talking about Muslims like they're all bad people. I'm just saying the facts are.
Mm-hmm. This was Pramila Jayapal who said that?
Yes, yeah. Yes. And so that's 1.3% of the U.S. population, by the way. So also, damn Yankee on the text line, the U.S. is weak under Biden, and the violent world has plotted to take advantage of the situation. It's war 101, and we are getting schooled.
Coming up on the Jeff Poor Show, former Congressman Parker Griffith in hour number one, Bradley Cox, who is a political consultant, in hour number two, and ALGOP Chairman John Wall in hour number three. Do a speed read through these texts.
Larry, you got it.
Larry from Daphne says, whoever Club for Growth says to not vote for is almost automatically who I vote for. And also we had Rock and Roll Doctor. And this is why I think it might end up being a tight race here in District 1. Rock and Roll Doctor said, let me inform you, Quinn, Carl voted to increase our debt limit just 4 months ago. Moore did not. There's certainly a difference between one, yeah, Carl, who keeps the credit cards unlimited, and the other, Moore, who says we can't afford this.
Now, well, they're not the same person or elected official at all.
Hal says the wreck at Cottage Hill and Knollwood is clear. Thank you, Hal. Gardner says, where should we spend money to protect the U.S., Israel, or Ukraine? And I think we can do more than one thing at a time. I just think the funnels are a little backwards. So there should be a lot more money going into protecting U.S. borders, making sure the home front is fortified,
yeah,
and then worry about what's going on internationally.
We want to make sure the home front is full of homies.
Yeah.
You know, homies being U.S. citizens.
Yeah, not enemies, right?
Yeah.
Grand Bay Gary says, who's going to fund our war? Radical Americans are going to want us eradicated. Yeah, we're all funding the war, and we will be for generations. Real Sam says, there's no way in the world Israel didn't know this was coming, not with their intelligence capabilities. It's very suspicious.
It is suspicious.
Jerry in Fort Morgan says, after the way our government pulled off the Russian hoax against Trump, I would be careful chasing the rabbit down the hole for the second time. Never believe anything you read, and buy lots of ammunition. Yeah, I try to read a lot. I never believe any of what I read, and try to get it from all sides, mm-hmm, if possible. Terry points out Houthis, Hamas, Hezbollah, all controlled by Iran. That's the case. And then this texter, millions have crossed the border. We don't know where or what religion they are. That's a big worry, for sure.
8:59, FM Talk 106.5, a minute away from news at the top of the hour, then the Jeff Poor Show. Dan and Dalton, tomorrow at 6 a.m.